This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear from our own Heidi Boghossian from Sarasota, telling us how the police erode our civil liberties at these mass demonstrations and protests.
We'll talk about the astonishing number of stops conducted under the New York City Police Department's Stop and Frisk program.
When a cop comes up to you on the street, should you run? Should you stand there? Should you let him search you? What should you do? Darius will explain, and explain also why New York has the highest number of stop and frisks in the United States, 700,000.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Last week saw a possible ray of hope on access to the documents and perhaps the transcript in the court-martial of Bradley Manning. As I'm sure you all know, the court-martial proceedings have been continuing at Fort Meade on a monthly basis. The trial date, or the court-martial date, is now set toward the end of February. Prior to that, there's been a series of motions, 2 and 3 days, on everything from classification to did the documents released through WikiLeaks cause harm, to what happened as a result of the torture of Bradley Manning in prison, etc. That's still continuing. During this period, I, along with a number of other lawyers, as well as a few journalists, have been trying to cover the trial, or at least go down there and see what's going on. It's been difficult for us because, unlike a regular trial, for some reason, even documents that are not secret are not being given to anyone outside of the lawyers who are actually on the case. So I don't get to see the documents. The Center for Constitutional Rights doesn't get to see the documents. The journalists don't get to see the documents. In other words, it's being held in secret despite the fact that the documents aren't secret.
Michael, what has the center done to try to get a hold of these documents?
Well, a couple of months ago, Heidi, we filed, more than a couple of months ago, probably 3 or 4 months ago, we filed a lawsuit, first with the judge, Judge Lind, who is hearing the Bradley Manning case. The case is called Center for Constitutional Rights versus United States of America and Colonel Denise Lind, military judge. Our plaintiffs include the center, WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, The Nation, Glenn Greenwald, Kevin Cazzola, Chase Madar, people we've had on the show, a number of the journalists from alternative papers particularly, who've been the only ones covering this. But all journalists are frustrated by the fact they can't get the papers. Well, we lost before the judge. We lost before the appeals court. And finally, in the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, which is the highest military court, we're getting a little bit of action. The court did order the government to respond and ask the judge to explain why she's not showing us any of the documents, what's going on here. And then finally, something we've been trying to get happen for a long time, is the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press filed an amicus brief in the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces saying that there's a First Amendment right for access to these documents, and they filed for themselves as well as for 31 news media organizations. Those news media organizations included the Washington Post, the New York Times, Gannett, AP, Hearst Corporation, etc. In other words, all the big ones. So hopefully that amicus brief will finally push the court to say the most important espionage or the most important military court-martial probably in 50 years that's going on should be open to the public, and the documents that are public should actually be public.
It's true, isn't it, that the U.S. Supreme Court has absolutely no jurisdiction over this sort of parallel military court system?
It's a tricky issue. We're going through the entire military court system. If we lose in the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, which I don't really expect to because it's such an outrageous proceeding that's going on, but you never know with the military. If we lose there, we do have a possibility of applying to the Supreme Court for certiorari, which is really saying the discretion of the court to take the case and possibly review it. Or we could conceivably start another action in a federal district court. But let's just hope that by the time that trial really rolls around in February, that the public is given access to, quote, public documents.
I wanted to add also, you mentioned the Press Freedom Association. Did you know that the U.S. press freedom rating dropped 27 places to number 47 this past year? I think in part we saw the police response to the Occupy movement influencing that significant drop in rating. I mean, that went down 20 places. But I would wonder if the Bradley Manning case and these related issues also impacts that drop in rating.
You know, I think, Heidi, your point about the Occupy Wall Street issue is really a good one. As you can tell us, the number of attacks on journalists covering Occupy Wall Street, and I don't just mean attacks in the media, I mean
physical attacks.
Physical. Destroying their cameras, pushing them around, arresting them.
Keeping them off the scene.
Right. New York City had to put in a whole new set of regulations, and even after that, what happened?
The police kept doing it.
Exactly. So I think that's probably, as you said, the most significant reason the U.S., quote, press freedom has dropped to what was the number?
It's down to number 47. It went down 27 places.
So now it's actually reflecting our infant mortality rate, our
exactly.
poverty rate, and other things. So I think that is
right.
the major factor. The other two are, I think, the prosecution of WikiLeaks and Bradley Manning, particularly Manning right now, because he's under indictment or under charges. And then I think the number of whistleblowers prosecuted under
That's
Obama.
Right.
The number is six. Six whistleblowers in all administrations put together prior to Obama.
Didn't even number that many.
Total three.
And he's been so harsh, too.
4 years, six.
Yeah.
So we're talking about a good reason for it dropping to...
And spying on journalists, too, James Risen.
Oh, that's also true, and threatening James Risen with first an indictment for exposing the warrantless wiretapping during the Bush administration, and now, of course, trying to compel him to testify against his source. So there's a good reason for it to drop to number 47. Three more places, there'll be a notch for every state in the union.
Right.
Almost as many affiliates as we have, Heidi.
Right.
Heidi, how many affiliates
do we
have?
We're up to 49.
So I want everybody to know we're at 49.
Let's go for 50.
Encourage your friends out there to carry and air Law and Disorder. We have 49 affiliates. We're probably hitting, what do you think, 20 million people have potential to
at
listen
least,
to our station?
At least, Michael, at least.
Well, New York alone, we have 8 million or more, 10 million.
They're tuning in.
So, the question is tuning in. Get them to tune in, but we want to make 50. We'd like to make 100 in 5 years. Heidi, in past shows, we've talked about using mace, tasers, etc., as ways of, quote, quelling protesters. And, of course, we've always been outraged by the use particularly of chemical weapons or tasers. But now we have an update that's really shocking, really shocking. Something to do with, Heidi, what is it?
School students. In a case that relates to the Birmingham School Department, the Birmingham Police Department policy for use of chemical spray in school settings, we have a judge ruling that a case can proceed as a class action. At least 100 students in Birmingham City High Schools are claiming that they were sprayed by chemical spray by Birmingham police officers assigned to the high schools. And they also provided training to so-called school resource officers. Now, what happened is, in the lawsuit, they lay out examples of students, teenagers, perhaps getting into a little disagreement among themselves, as teenagers are wont to do. But what's happened is, over a five-year period starting in 2006, these school resource officers actually use chemical spray on about 100 students. And the Birmingham Police Department does not have a specific policy concerning these school resource officers' use of chemical spray. They just, I guess, use their general policy concerning non-deadly use of forces, but it's not appropriate, clearly, in a school setting. So the lawsuit, which was filed 2 years ago, and a judge just ruled it can proceed as a class action, basically deals with the numbers of students who have been sprayed, sometimes directly in the eyes, during, you know, what I would call minor obedience discipline settings, minor inter-student disagreements. And then, as well, the second group of people are those who have been sprayed as sort of bystanders, so that the students are sprayed and then bystanders are affected.
I was looking at the lawsuit, Heidi, and it says that many children have been sprayed with mace while they're fully restrained and without any warning. So they're already restrained from whatever they were doing, and then they're obviously maced, which is incredible to me.
Exactly. One example, they use the initials KB, a 10th grader, 4 months pregnant, was approached by a male student who made some inappropriate sexual comments. KB cried, walked away, but the student followed her. She went into her class in tears, and there, a SRO, the student resource officer, grabbed her, telling her to calm down. She kept crying, and then he sprayed her with chemical spray and handcuffed her. Now, she was allegedly nauseated. Her eyes and face were burned. Her breathing was affected. I've never heard of this, Michael.
And when you read some of the effects, well, they're what you would expect. Blistering and scarring of the eye, temporary loss of vision or blurred vision, chemical burns, difficulty breathing, severe or life-threatening asthma attacks. I have a question, Heidi. While the lawsuit's pending, are they still using it? Do you know?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know, but it's worth mentioning this lawsuit was brought by the Southern Poverty Law Center. You know, to me, it sounds like one of these really antiquated, barbaric practices that I'm quite surprised we haven't really heard about this before, because we've heard about protesters being sprayed with less lethal weapons, as they call them, CS gas, and that violates human rights norms. This clearly, when it's close up and when it's used in addition to physical restraint by these school officers, seems to me to be punitive, almost rising to the level of torture.
If any of our listeners know anything about the use of mace, particularly on students, please get in touch with the Southern Poverty Law Center or get in touch with us through the website lawanddisorder.org. We go now to hear a presentation by our own Heidi Bogosian. Heidi spoke at an event sponsored by station affiliate WSLR in Sarasota. As the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild, Heidi had coordinated and organized legal observers during the Republican National Convention in Tampa and the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte. While in Florida, Heidi delivered a talk about the eroding civil rights of protesters during national special security events, pre-event surveillance, and tactical strategies deployed by police. Let's have a listen.
We have the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. I believe your 75th anniversary was pretty recently. The NLG is a storied organization. It is a principled organization, and I am not the right person to give you the details of their history, except to say that we are privileged to have their national executive director with us and to get an insight as to what can be done about the RNC and the various protest activities there. And for that, Heidi Bogosian.
It's truly an honor to be here. This is the first time I've visited one of Law and Disorder's affiliate stations. And I love your space. It's just really a thrill for me. The Guild is celebrating its 75th year, and I want to just say that over the years, we have worked very closely with many ACLU chapters around the country. In California especially, we often litigate together. And in the wake of 9/11, we came together on a number of efforts, so we value that relationship. I want to share what we have found to be a formula that has worked well for government agencies and for corporations seeking to rebrand modern-day protest and activism. Anyone in this room who has seen local news coverage of the RNC is already familiar with one large component of that formula. Today's news websites and newspapers are full of alarming headlines, all citing a single FBI and DHS intelligence bulletin. The bulletin is for internal law enforcement use. It doesn't appear on the FBI or Department of Homeland Security websites, but it somehow made its way into major newsrooms around the country. In it, federal intelligence officers warn that protesters are planning to close the Tampa Bay bridges and might try to use improvised explosive devices. They warn that anarchists could block roads, use acid-filled eggs to protest the convention, one headline reads. And I just got an email from one of my colleagues who's setting up our legal office in Tampa. Apparently, there's a new headline saying that police found bricks, pipes, and other, quote, suspicious items on a roof about a mile from the convention center. There was apparently a little graffiti that they attribute to anarchists, and so they're concerned, and this is now a headline story. We've seen this before, the other RNCs in New York. There were full-page tabloid stories proclaiming that violent anarchists were coming to town. They even published a list of names of the 50 leading anarchists, several of whom I know to be wonderful, peaceful activists who have committed their lives to changing some policies that we disagree with. But this is the first part of the formula, and it's a formula that the Guild, and I'm sure many of you are aware of, media portrayal of protesters as violent anarchists. Stories in 2008 in the RNC in St. Paul highlighted raids of activist houses there based on anonymous tips. What we find is that rarely does the mainstream press follow up on those colorful, provocative headlines weeks or months later, when it turns out the charges were dropped, that the household items that were found during a raid, bottles of bleach, old rags, were really just ordinary objects like those found on the rooftop today that many of us have, to which police ascribes evil intent. Nor do reporters, as often as they might, examine the social justice issues that the unions, anti-war groups, environmental groups, and so many others are trying to bring to the forefront at the RNC. It's worth noting that the U.S. Press Freedom Rating dropped 27 places to number 47 in the world, due in large part to the police response to Occupy, which received a lot of coverage for overreaching police tactics. The second part of the equation that we've seen, especially since the WTO protest in 1999 in Seattle, is aggressive, unconstitutional policing tactics. Preemptive policing, where the police will opt, instead of isolating one or two troublemakers who may break the law, instead of isolating and arresting them, they will conduct large, what we call trap and arrests, where they will encircle hundreds of people and arrest them without probable cause, detaining them often for days so that they are, in effect, kept off the streets during the RNC or the DNC and out of sight of the delegates. The Occupy events over this past year have helped shine a spotlight on those practices that we feel have been gaining momentum for years, but have not always been captured in the media or resonated as strongly in the public eye as they did when, for example, at the beginning of Occupy in New York, police sprayed pepper spray directly into a passive protester's eyes. Over the past year, we saw trap and arrest. 700 individuals were, we believe, led, and this is in court now, but we believe the evidence will show that the police gave indication to the protesters at an early Occupy Wall Street event that they were allowed to proceed on the car way of the Brooklyn Bridge. All of a sudden, orders to disperse were given, which only the few people at the beginning of the march could hear, and then they were all arrested. And Guild members have gone forward with a class action lawsuit on that case. We've seen, as you know, the deployment of expensive police equipment, often military in nature, tanks, which I know Tampa has, used to intimidate protesters, often highlighted in the news so that people who may never have exercised their First Amendment right, but who want to come out to a political convention will say, look at those tanks and the body armor and all the tear gas they're bringing in. We think it has a chilling effect on free speech in that it not only intimidates people when they're on the ground, but precludes many from coming. In New York, we saw helicopters deployed to hover over marches of 20 people at Occupy Wall Street. We saw a constant maze of barricades erected around Wall Street. We saw journalists and city council members pushed blocks away while they showed their ID, and in many cases arrested to keep them from observing police protester interactions. We saw the overcharging to keep police in custody for longer than they ordinarily would have been held on misdemeanor charges. We saw false alerts that threats existed to police officer safety. We saw the photographing of disorderly conduct arrestees and other offenses for which individuals are usually not photographed, if they're even put through the system. And we saw extended detention for people who refused to have so-called voluntary iris scans. That's a new procedure they're using in New York. Allegedly, they say, to prevent individuals from escaping. We believe it's to amass yet another kind of data bank on politically active individuals. Throughout all of these instances, over months of intense police presence at Occupy Wall Street, we saw what we've seen at national special security events around the country for years. Police department with a primary objective of clearing the streets, frightening people, and then dealing with the consequences of police breaking the law down the road, often after people are put through the system and had to come back if they were from out of town at their own expense for court hearings. In a disturbing trend, we see officers disregarding the law and setting as a priority the monitoring of political events instead of responding to ordinary crimes that may be happening at a given moment. We asked officers at Union Square in New York a few months ago when they started enacting a midnight curfew that had never been imposed, because it's a very open park with entrances on all sides so that people who live on either side can walk through rather than take the long route around. So they started imposing a midnight curfew and cleaning the park, hosing it down with big trucks, which they'd never done. But we asked one officer why hundreds of officers in riot gear, and he just said it's a priority now. We've also witnessed what I think is a third component of our equation, and it's really the one that informs the first two, the media, the excessive use of force, is spying and infiltration by the government and by corporations who are often the targets of protest. In New York, Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan Chase are funding massive surveillance operations, which in the wake of Occupy introduce new fears of selective policing based on the content of the message. We witnessed the impact of government and corporate spying during the Occupy movement, and we continue to see the impact at NSSE events like the RNC. The intelligence report citing anarchist threats could well be based on such innocuous information as activist flyers or websites that are commonly spread weeks or months before the convention, containing constitutionally protected First Amendment speech, politically rhetorical speech, such as shut down the convention. Made public at the height of Occupy was the extent to which big business does partner with public law enforcement, not just in spying, but in handing over bankrolls of money to support public police initiatives. In one New York lawsuit brought on behalf of Occupy protesters, the plaintiffs alleged that private corporations played a key role in curtailing their free speech. An agreement was formed between the City of New York, the Transit Authority, the mayor, Police Commissioner Ray Kelly, along with J.P. Morgan, Brookfield Properties, which was in charge of the park where the Occupy encampment was, to basically deprive protesters of their right to access public spaces that were on the private property. So in exchange for, say, Chase building a building of a very high, tall building, they would say when they struck the agreement, we'll make this a public park in front. The complaint alleged the banks and the police department denied access to that public space at 1 Chase Manhattan Plaza because shortly after the police barricades were removed, a private fence was erected. Documents obtained by the National Lawyers Guild through FOIA requests do confirm vast monitoring, surveillance, and information sharing between the Department of Homeland Security and local authorities all around the country in response to Occupy. And we know that this is going on all different levels. We obtained documents in partnership with the DC-based group, the Partnership for Civil Justice, and Michael Moore. Heavily redacted, they still suggest a massive spying network exists, supported, as you may know, by anti-terrorism funding, which is very attractive to local police departments, because if they can identify terrorist threats locally, they can apply for funding to bolster their equipment and their police forces. in a case you might have heard about where the New York District Attorney subpoenaed the tweets of an individual arrested on that mass arrest on the Brooklyn Bridge. A Guild member, Martin Stoller, just filed a civil suit to block disclosure of the tweets, even though the judge said it was permissible because they had been out in the public, based on the fact that they would also reveal 3 months of geographic contact information during that period to show where that individual had been tweeting from. The activist in this case, Malcolm Harris, who's a writer in Brooklyn, likened the request to surveillance, saying that the tweets are public except when they're accumulated in that fashion. As you know, government agencies target the leaders of political movements. They've even used snatch squads at RNCs, and they've even snatched legal observers for the Guild at the FTAA ministerial protest years ago. By coming up in a van, and police with black masks literally took Miles Swanson, one of our young legal observers, whose picture had been put in a PowerPoint presentation that local law enforcement showed to local businesses a couple of weeks before. And as I think is happening in Tampa, there's been some closing down of businesses for several days during this week. It's part of the fear-mongering. You need to shutter everything up to avoid having your windows smashed. We see the targeting not only of leaders, mentioning of legal observers, which we've heard from two members here that in presentations by law enforcement, they were mentioned that we are friends of anarchists, but employing grand juries to search for evidence of political affiliation, which is improper. To visit, have visits by the FBI weeks or months in advance of these events around the country when they've identified activists who they think will be traveling. And they question them about, why are you going? Who else is going? We set up a hotline when the FBI announced that environmental and animal rights activists were the number one domestic terrorism threat back in 2004. We call it the Green Scare Hotline, but now we use it for general FBI visits. So when activists are called, we advise them, don't talk to them, get a lawyer, don't give them any information, and of course, don't lie to them. When movements such as ours become casualties of government and corporate spying and disruption, civic trust is undermined, vital political debates are stifled, and as you know, there are far-reaching societal consequences for us all. As the world's superpower, this nation wields major influence on other countries. We feel that by punishing domestic dissenters, the U.S. sends a signal to others that we no longer cherish the First Amendment. And we see countries around the globe mirroring at times our version of the war on terrorism by prosecuting their own political opponents, religious groups, and separatists. At the Guild, when we speak, we encourage people not to be afraid of these tactics, of this formula, which is based on the so-called Miami model. We must continue to ignite anger in the hearts and minds of Americans and not let people slip into complacency. If we allow campaigns of disinformation, such as the things we're seeing in the media this week, taking household objects and making it sound as though we have terrorist homemade bombs, if we allow that to continue, we become complicit in the horrors perpetrated in the name of big business and the national security state. As Occupy Wall Street gained momentum in what we think was perhaps the single largest surge of protests since the Vietnam War, and as protesters traveled to Chicago and now Tampa and Charlotte, police and local governments' response reflects growing animosity toward activism in general. In sharp contrast, the many creative forms of protest that occupiers engaged in, their encampments from the very small to large that sprung to life, fostered a sense of community and creative dissent that has so long been missing in this country. I think we owe a debt of gratitude to the thousands of individuals who joined to make the Occupy movement and the protesters coming here this week. We owe them a debt of gratitude because they serve as a wake-up call for the rest of the country and hopefully for the rest of the world. Thank you.
That was our own Heidi Boghossian at an event sponsored by our affiliate, WSLR in Sarasota.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Madness, madness, they call it madness. Madness, madness, they call it madness. It's plain to see that is what they mean to me. Madness, madness, I call it madness. Madness, madness, they call it madness. Madness, madness, they call it madness. I'm about to explain that someone is using his brain. Madness, madness, they call it madness.
Today we're joined by Darius Charney, a lawyer at the Center for Constitutional Rights, to give us an update on stop and frisk in New York, but really talking about stop and frisk throughout the country. Darius addresses what are the rights of a police or a cop to stop and frisk you? What are your rights in saying no to that? What risks do you take by saying no? Darius will also update us on the lawsuit the Center for Constitutional Rights has filed to try and change probably the worst stop and frisk tactics in the country, New York City, where almost 700,000 people will be stopped and frisked this year. Almost 90% of those stopped and frisked are Black or Latino in a city that is only about half Black and Latino. New York City justifies it by its claimed lower crime rate. But in fact, as Darius will explain, it has no justification at all. None in New York, none in other cities where it is used routinely by police to intimidate communities of color.
Darius, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we take the term stop and frisk for granted here, mm-hmm. but for our listeners who aren't in New York City, can you explain what a stop and frisk is?
Sure. When we say stop, we're really talking about a detention of somebody's liberty by the police, albeit briefer than an arrest, but it is a situation where a police officer or a group of police officers will detain somebody, briefly on the street, and oftentimes will search them, which is what a frisk is. And by frisk, we mean a pat down of the outside of somebody's clothing, as opposed to going inside of their clothing, which is commonly referred to as a search. But in either case, for the purposes of the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, we are talking about a seizure when somebody is stopped. In other words, their liberty is being taken away from them for a period of time. And then when they are frisked, we're talking about a search of their, outside of their clothing.
And is this for the purpose of looking for a gun that might hurt the officer or for contraband?
Well, that's a good question, because the police department here in New York says that the reason they do these stops and frisks is because they're looking for illegal weapons. But we know from, all the data we've seen over the past decade, really, that just isn't true. And the reason it's not true is because about 99.3% of the time, they find no gun. The other thing about it is that the vast majority of the stops that are done in New York City are on suspicion of nonviolent crimes, oftentimes quality of life crimes like trespassing, vandalism, drinking in public. So for the police department to say they're doing this because they're looking for weapons just isn't true.
Let me go back for one second. Mm-hmm. I'm walking down the street. Yeah. A cop sees me. Can he just search me because he feels like searching me? Or does there have to be some kind of, is there an objective standard?
Yes.
What is the standard?
Well, according to the United States Supreme Court, in a case that they decided about 44 years ago called Terry versus Ohio, for a police officer to stop somebody on the street, they have to have what's called reasonable articulable suspicion. What that means is kind of hard to say. We know it's a lower standard than, what most people know as probable cause, but it has to be more than just a hunch or a whim or a, you know, subjective belief that somebody's doing something wrong. There has to be, you know, articulable, specific facts that the officer is aware of that would cause him or her to reasonably believe that this person has committed a crime, is in the process of committing a crime, or is about to commit a crime.
And this is true throughout the United States. Yes. That's the same standard.
Yes.
Now, I know that New York and maybe some other states as well have special training tapes that teach cops how to do what's reasonable suspicion is, I guess, the term. And I remember looking at an article, you probably can help us with this, but you know, if I'm walking past a bunch of cars and I sort of, quote, furtively look into a car and a cop's watching me, I think in my case, because I'm sort of a white guy, a white old guy, right, looking around, that furtive look, he's probably not going to stop me for that. Mm-hmm. But it's conceivable that if I'm Latino or black or young or some other category, he might stop me for that. So yes. Give me some sense of what that's about, furtive looking into a car or something. I mean, is that really a basis for stopping somebody? Well, isn't it then really based on my appearance more than anything?
I think you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, you know, the federal courts that have dealt with this issue over the years they've not really set, you know, clear-cut standards, but I think they have, there seems to be a consensus that a furtive movement alone, you know, some kind of quick movement, somebody looked in a car, somebody put something in their pocket, that by itself is not enough of a basis for an officer to believe, you know, reasonably suspect someone for a crime. The reason it gets complicated, of course, is because officers will say, well, it wasn't just that they were moving, you know, suspiciously. It was also because, you know, this kid had a puffy jacket on, or he was in a neighborhood that we know there have been a lot of, you know, car break-ins. So that's when it starts to get fuzzy. And that's where I think, you know, there's room for abuse by officers and for their biases to come into the calculation.
Okay, so I'm walking down the street. Mm-hmm. The cop has to have reasonable suspicion. Of course, that's, as you said, very hard to articulate, and they probably use all kinds of bad factors. Oh, he approaches me on the street, and he comes up to me. What does he say to me, and what rights do I have?
Well, you know, I can tell you what your rights are under the law, and then I can tell you, you know, what the reality on the street, which, you know, I think is important for people to think about so they stay safe. Well, you know, if an officer stops a person and asks them, you know, and they actually have reasonable suspicion, which of course the person can't know at the time, the person is not free to leave. In other words, they can't just ignore the officer and walk away. If they do, that gives the officer grounds to then even take it a step further and possibly arrest the person. But let's assume for the moment that they did have reasonable suspicion. If they didn't, the person could ignore the officer, and that's not supposed to give the officer a reason to then detain you. But if they have reasonable suspicion and they stop to ask you questions, you're supposed to answer the questions. Now, they may ask you for identification. If you don't have identification, that's not against the law in New York State, so you know you don't have to provide it to them.
It may be against the law in some states, so we want to warn people.
Yes,
New York, you don't have to provide identification. Yes.
For them to then, so they can ask you questions, you know, which, you know, you're free to not answer, but, you know, depending on what the questions are, if you don't answer them, that may give the officer a basis, you know, to have probable cause to arrest you. But assuming you're just having a conversation, you answer the questions, you know, where are you going, what are you doing, that kind of thing. For the officer to then take it to the next step and actually put his or her hands on you, they have to have reasonable suspicion that you're armed and dangerous. It can't just be that, oh, they think you might have drugs in your pocket or you might have a stolen something in your pocket. They actually have to fear for their safety. They have to have a reasonable belief that you might have a weapon or that you, you know, could commit an act of violence against them. Other than that, the only way they can put their hands on you is if you consent to it. So, you know, there have been situations we've been aware of where officers may ask a person, is it okay if I look in your bag? Is it okay if I, you know, pat you down? And you have a right to say no to that. And that, once you say no, the officer can't search you or even frisk you unless they have that reasonable, articulable suspicion. The law also says you can ask the officer why they're stopping you. They're supposed to tell you. You can ask the officer for their name and badge number if you want to file a complaint against them at a later point. Those are all your rights under the law as the laws are written. But, of course, the reality on the street is that officers don't comply with the law a lot of times. And they also oftentimes get angry or irritated if you assert the rights that you have. And so what commonly happens here in New York, and I think in other places, is if somebody does kind of assert their rights, the officer may retaliate against them by, you know, issuing them a ticket for disorderly conduct, or, you know, placing them under arrest for disorderly conduct. And of course, disorderly conduct means whatever an officer wants it to mean. You know, you're causing trouble, you're being uppity or something like that. So, you know, there's definitely a difference between what happens on the street and what your rights are. But I think what we tell people is the most important thing is to get through the encounter safely and to be able to then go on with your life. So, you know, answering questions, you know, I think it's okay to say I don't consent to a search, and it's obviously okay to ask for these things like a badge number and a name. But if you're sensing that an officer is not appreciating your behavior, is getting irritated, is starting to escalate the situation, we recommend people just, you know, be quiet and try to get through it as quickly as possible.
I have a question about plainclothes officers. Mm-hmm. In your experience, are there statistics showing, I assume most of these mm-hmm. stop and frisks are uniformed officers, but are there plainclothes as well? And wouldn't that change the dynamic between the individual stopped?
Those are good questions. Actually, you know, from what our look at the data, I can't say a majority of the stops are by plainclothes, but there are a large number of stops by officers in what are called anti-crime units, which are plainclothes units that drive around in unmarked cars. So there are a lot of stops by plainclothes officers. And, you know, in those situations, again, if an officer, once they actually interact with a person, they stop them, they're supposed to identify themselves as a police officer. They're supposed to, you know, pull their badge out of their shirt and show it to people, which they, again, do not always do. You know, we have talked to folks who've said in those situations when they've asked the person, because they didn't believe the person was a police officer, show me your badge, that officers oftentimes react angrily to that. So again, a civilian has a right to say, you know, show me your badge. You say you're a cop, show me your badge. And the officer is supposed to do so, but whether or not it happens is a different matter and can oftentimes lead to escalation.
So we've gotten through what stop and frisk is, what it is mm-hmm. in New York, what it is in other cities. And I know you're one of the lawyers on a long-running set of litigation that the Center for Constitutional Rights has brought against the New York City Police Department, mm-hmm. starting with the killing of Amadou Diallo in 1999 in the first case, Daniels v. New York, which then gave you a statistical basis for beginning to look at stop and frisks because mm-hmm. the court ordered mm-hmm. statistics be kept on stop and frisks. Mm-hmm. So what's the current case? It's called Floyd, and what have the statistics shown? And then let's talk about the litigation.
Okay, well, the statistics that we've been looking at really since 2003 have shown, first of all, an explosion of stop and frisk in New York City. I mean, it's become an epidemic. In the Bloomberg-Kelly era, you know, which is now we're in, I think, entering, what, year 11 of their administration, stop and frisk has increased over 600% in New York City. The first year of their administration, 2002, we had about 90,000 stops by officers. Last year, we were approaching 700,000. And this is in an era of really flat, you know, crime rates. It's not as if we've had, you know, a huge increase in crime in the city, which may, I mean, I'm not saying it would, but maybe that would be an argument for more aggressive policing. But we've seen crime either go down or be flat for those 10 years, and yet the stop and frisk has exploded. We've seen just very disturbing racial disparities in who is being stopped. You know, it's almost 90% of the stops are of Black and Latino New Yorkers, and this is true across the city. If you go to a majority minority neighborhood, if you go to a racially mixed neighborhood, it's Blacks and Latinos that are the ones being stopped almost 9 out of 10 times.
And the city's 52% Black and Latino. Mm-hmm. You're saying the stops are something like 90%.
Yes, and then the other piece, which I alluded to earlier, is that the rate of return, so to speak, on these stops is almost non-existent. I mean, they found 800 guns last year, which, you know, may sound like, oh, that's a big number, 800 guns. But when you consider it was almost 700,000 stops that it took to get those 800 guns, you know, and that in a single weekend, the police can get that much in a gun buyback program, really, I think, begs the question, are these stops necessary?
Darius, talk a bit, if you will, about ComStat and mm-hmm. the effect that has had on these figures.
Well, I think it's had a very direct effect. You know, ComStat was a program that was created under Giuliani and Bill Bratton, his first police commissioner. And the idea behind it was to use data to really make decisions about, you know, where to devote police resources. And in some ways, it was a good idea because, you know, they'd look at crime rates around the city and decide, okay, well, we look like we have a lot of crime in this neighborhood, so we need more officers over here. But what it's turned into is it's turned into a numbers game that is really being used to measure officer performance and you know the quality of a police officer's work solely by how many stops or arrests or tickets they write, and that's really caused, I think, a perverse incentive for officers to just do these things, stop people, you know, frisk them, shake them down so that they can get a promotion. You know, whether or not the arrest was justified or the stop was justified is pretty much beside the fact for them. They just want to get their numbers up, and it's caused, I think it's definitely contributed to this explosion.
Now, does financial incentive factor into any of this? In other words, are there grants, be it from Homeland Security or other places, that would make more stop and frisks something the administration wants to engage in?
You know, they would never admit that, but I think that may be what's going on here because, you know, they do get a lot of federal money that they have to show they're using to, you know, bring down gun violence or, you know, address drug use. And so, I mean, again, it's a very easily quantifiable way to do that is to say, well, look how many drug arrests we made last month. And I think you guys all know about the explosion of the marijuana arrests in the city, you know, over the past 10 years or actually 15 or 20 years, you know, that New York Police Department's arresting something like 50,000 people a year for essentially just possession of small amounts of marijuana, which in many cases is not even a crime. It's a violation. I think, you know, that small amounts of marijuana possession was decriminalized in New York State in the 70s.
Does a lot of that happen from stop and frisks?
Absolutely. You look at the demographics of who's arrested for these offenses, it's overwhelmingly young Black and Latino men, and we all know that when you talk about marijuana use in New York or nationally, that, you know, white folks use it as much, if not more, than Blacks and Latinos, yet these arrests are mostly of Black and Latino young men, and that's because they most often happen as part of a stop and frisk.
Let's go to two areas on this. One is the lawsuit, and then the community activism on this. So the lawsuit was filed
2008, and last week we were given a trial date in the case of March 18th, 2013. So to everyone out there who's interested in this issue, we encourage you to keep close tabs on this because the New York Police Department's stop and frisk practices are literally going to be put on trial in a federal court in Manhattan this coming spring.
Now, you're looking for people to call in or to talk about that with you? Or?
Well, we have a website set up because, you know, we were certified as a class action in May by the judge in our case. And so we have a website for class members. So folks who believe they have been illegally stopped and frisked over the past 7 years since 2005 could be members of this class. And if you think you're one of those people, you can go to www.stopandfrisklawsuit.com and you can fill out an online questionnaire which will be completely confidential. Only the lawyers in the case will see it, describing your experiences and letting us know whether you're interested in possibly being a trial witness or getting involved in the advocacy around this issue.
Now, what are you asking for in the lawsuit? What kind of result can you get? I mean, how do you really stop? 700,000 stop and frisks is extraordinary. And what can you do about it?
Well, I think the number one thing that, you know, we've learned the hard way over the past decade and or so doing this work is that we cannot leave it to the New York Police Department to fix the problem on their own. In other words, they cannot police themselves. There's going to have to be independent and outside oversight of this police department for, I would say, several years to ensure that they make real changes, to ensure that they are, you know, training and supervising their officers to respect people. Rights. And we don't think they're going to be able to do that on their own. They've shown over the past 10 years that they can't do it on their own or they're unwilling to. So, you know, whether that's a federal court monitor, whether it's somebody from the state attorney general's office or the federal Department of Justice, there has to be independent oversight of the police department. And that's the primary thing. And in terms of other changes, you know, I think what we are going to try to do over the next several months is really not only get input from, you know, kind of the experts in this field around the country, but to get input from the communities that are most affected by this practice in New York to find out, you know, what do you think would help the situation, would help you feel safer when you're around the police, to trust the police? What do you need for the police department to understand about your neighborhood to make sure that they're doing things effectively and legally?
I find it interesting that in addition to the need for oversight, there is no requirement currently that NYPD identify themselves to the public. Mm-hmm. So for those officers that are wearing the badge on their neck that's not visible, isn't there also a public safety argument that I would think officers would want that because there have been so many friendly fire instances?
No, you would think. I've heard the detectives and the other undercovers say, well, you know, we need to be kind of inconspicuous to do our jobs. But I guess, you know, to your point, once they are interacting with somebody, once they're in a tense situation, it seems to me that if they identify they're an officer, it may actually help diffuse the situation, you know, because if somebody comes up to me and puts their hands on me and I'm like, who the heck are you? And I get angry, if they tell me they're a police officer, that may, you know, at least, okay, so I see you're doing this not because you're just trying to be a jerk, or at least, you know, I hope you're not doing it to be a jerk. You're doing it because you're trying to fight crime. It may de-escalate. So I agree with you. And I think that goes into the other point that I think Michael was wanting to talk about, which is some of the other activism around this issue. There's currently a series of bills that's been introduced in the New York City Council called the Community Safety Act, which is a series of bills to address a lot of these problems. And one of those pieces of legislation would make it, you know, city law that a police officer, whenever they stop you, is going to have to volunteer that they are a police officer and show their badge and identify themselves.
And, of course, there's a community group out there. Mm-hmm. What's it called that you guys work with?
The Communities United for Police Reform. We have the acronym CPR. And we also have a website, which is www.changethenypd.org, where you can find out information about some of the other activities we're involved in. You know, there's legislative advocacy. There's Know Your Rights trainings, Cop Watch trainings, which I'm a big fan of, and other stuff that we're involved in.
Darius, many months ago we interviewed several students who participated in Know Your Rights trainings, and I think as we talk about this statistically, it's one thing, but when you look at the human impact that it has on young children who are brought up to expect that as they're leaving school or walking down the streets, this is a daily part of their life. I just can't imagine the sort of psychological toll this takes in their maturation process and how it affects their daily lives.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the real tragedies of this whole policy and this practice of the police department is it's really causing, you know, young people and people in communities that I think really need the police's help, it's causing them to just be very afraid and distrustful of the police and you know, for good reason, you know, and to view the police as an occupying force, to view them as not there to protect them, but there to actually oppress them. I think that's one of the things that the police department is really doing itself a disservice and making its own job harder, because in order to fight crime, I mean, any policing expert will tell you that you need the, you know, you need to work together with the community. And if the community doesn't trust you, if they fear you, that's not going to happen. And I think the police department's really, you know, shooting itself in the foot by doing this practice, because it's alienating large, you know, swaths of communities in this city that really, I think, have a lot to contribute to the crime-fighting efforts, but they don't want to go to the police.
Now, the center has documented some of that. And,
yes.
And there's a publication that people can get online or sent to them?
Yes.
It's quite good on this, I think.
It's called Stop and Frisk, The Human Impact, The Stories Behind the Numbers, The Effects on Our Communities. And it's a report that we put out in July, which you can get on our website, www.ccrjustice.org, and it contains a series of interviews with folks from all over the city from different backgrounds about their experiences with Stop and Frisk, and also their attitudes about the police, which I think are very much affected by their experiences with Stop and Frisk.
I want to spread this out a little bit, and of course the basic Stop and Frisk law applies across the country. and look at some of the other places where this has been a problem. Philadelphia, for example, they've dealt with it a bit differently, but talk a little about Philadelphia and then why you see it being different in some cities versus others.
Well, Philadelphia was sued as well in 2010, and their mayor and police commissioner's response was completely 180 degrees different from New York. I mean, within, I think, 6 months, they had reached an agreement with the plaintiffs to make a lot of very, I think, significant changes to their stop and frisk practices, how they document, how they monitor, you know, the way they're going to train their officers on this stuff, and are really working together with the community to not only address, you know, the problems, but to really figure out how they can both, you know, protect the public and keep the city safe as well as respect people's rights. You know, contrast that to New York, where we're now going on, you know, 13 years fighting this fight, and the city won't even admit that they've done anything wrong. It's, you know, it's a completely different situation. Outside of New York and Philadelphia, you know, a lot of other cities that we've looked at, they just don't use stop and frisk as much as New York does. And I think there's a, you know, a couple reasons for that. One being, of course, that New York is much more of a walking city, so it's, you know, a lot more pedestrians. So, you know, other cities maybe use traffic stops a little bit more than stop and frisk. But
yeah, and the New Jersey Turnpike, for example, we had for years and still do, driving while black,
absolutely,
as being a crime.
Yeah, in Maryland as well. And then also, you know, in Los Angeles, they were sued in the end of the Clinton administration by the Justice Department for, you know, racially discriminatory traffic stops. But, you know, another piece of it, I think, is that, you know, again, going back to Comstat and the broken windows policing philosophy, New York was the pioneer of that, and I think continues to be the most aggressive user of that philosophy, and I think that translates into all these stops. You know, I think what the NYPD apologists refer to it as proactive policing. You know, in other words, we're going to intervene before there's, you know, anything wrong has happened. But of course, you really, it's a really slippery slope, because, you know, if nothing wrong has happened, if someone's not doing anything wrong, what basis does an officer have to interfere with their liberty? So, you know, I think that's another piece of this, is that New York, you know, the policing philosophy here is very much in favor of aggressive tactics like stop and frisk.
Well, Darius, it's been a pleasure as usual to have you on, and this is such an important case for all New Yorkers.
And tell us once more where people can go for more information to help out with the case, etc.
StopandFriskLawsuit.com, and then we have the website for the Communities United for Police Reform, which is www.changethenypd.org.
Great. Well, thank you, Darius. Good luck.
Good
in
luck.
March 2013, right?
We look forward to it.
Thank you for having me.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.